We are about to listen live to a feed from China. President Obama is about to deliver a news conference there. He has gone to China to a meeting of the G20, the leaders of the world's largest economies, a regular meeting that takes on special significance because it is President Obama's last and because it is in the world's second largest economy, China, which shines a light on perhaps the world's most important relationship between the United States and China. They are in Hangzhou, a city outside of Shanghai, which suggests the sheer scale of China. It's a fair guess that most Americans have never even heard of this city. It has a population of roughly 9 million people outside of Shanghai. Now, as we await this news conference, we're going to talk here with NPR's Scott Horsley, among others. He's in our studio. Scott, good morning.
Good to be with you, Steve.
And so what has the president been focusing on the last couple of days?
Well, it's been a busy weekend of diplomacy for this president. As you say, this is he's there for the G20, his 10th G20 meeting, and this is a summit that's focused a lot on the economy, the global economy. But while he's there, he's also having pull-aside meetings with other world leaders and talking today, for example, with President Putin of Russia. He met earlier with Chancellor Merkel of Germany. He has met with Hollande, President Hollande of France. And, of course, he met one-on-one with Xi when he arrived on Saturday.
And let's bring in another voice to this conversation. Robert Daly is in our studios also. He is director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars, which is here in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
And let's pick up on this relationship. What is the state of relations between the United States and China at this moment?
Well, if we look at the relationship broadly, at everything that's going on between the Chinese and American people, universities, corporations, it's fairly strong. Yet strategic and ideological mistrust between the two countries is at an all-time high, and it's concentrated now on the question of what happens in the South China Sea.
Which, by the way, is worth talking about because it is certainly something I don't think Americans quite understand, although it is quite a serious issue, and that has to do with China intending to dominate an area in the South China Sea.
Right. China sees this sea as its proper sphere of influence, that China's birthright, its historical destiny, is to have at least a zone of deference, to be able to call the shots in the South China Sea, which is of tremendous strategic importance to the United States and many of our allies as well.
And it's building islands and a military base.
Small military facilities in the South China Sea, yes, but not a full base.
Small military facilities on created land, right? Reclaimed land, as they would say, taking submerged rocks and turning them into islands.
Land that has been built on, yes, submerged rocks and reefs, which a decision of the Permanent Court of Arbitration in early July said that these features could not cast any territorial seas. And China has taken issue with that, has refused to acknowledge this finding of the court in The Hague.
Now, we have major issues to discuss here, but sometimes these major tensions get expressed in relatively minor diplomatic squabbles, and there certainly has been one. The controversy of the stairs, the great stair controversy of 16. Scott Horsley, what happened when President Obama arrived in China?
Well, you know, whenever the president travels to China, there's always a little bit of a squabble between the Chinese protocol officials and the White House protocol officials about who's going to stand where, how many reporters are going to be allowed to accompany the president. The White House always stands up for the U.S. press corps, saying, look, we brought these guys along to see our president in action. The Chinese try to keep a tight lid on things and control on the press. So when the reporters traveling with the president landed in Hangzhou, they were prevented from going to their normal spot under the wing to photograph the sort of ceremonial arrival of the president.
I can picture that in my mind's eye, coming down the high staircase from the high spot on the 747.
And then in this case, there was no high staircase. The Chinese kept the White House team from bringing in the staircase that lets the president make the grand entrance from the upper deck of the 747, and instead he had to come out the belly of the airplane.
Come out the belly of the airplane. There's another stairs.
There's a built-in staircase, but so the optics were, you know, the optics were interesting.
Robert Daly, is this just chance?
This is not chance at all. This is very much part of an emergent Chinese style, some of which they studied from us over the years. But we have seen China as Xi Jinping steps out and makes more foreign trips become, frankly, more obnoxious to some of its hosts. We heard Queen Elizabeth very uncharacteristically in May commiserating with the London chief of police who had dealt with the Chinese advance team.
And we are not amused.
We are not amused. And when the chief of police said, I'm the one who had to deal with the Chinese, the queen was heard saying, oh, bad luck.
What did they do to the queen? Or to the chief of police, for that matter.
Well, they insisted on Chinese prerogatives, as Scott has said. When you come to China, you do it our way. And when China comes to London, you do it our way as well. They were quite rude to the UK ambassador to China. They actually walked out on her.
What does this stuff matter?
It matters because China wants to be seen as a world leader, to be seen as setting standards, and especially to be seen as respected. What's going on in Hangzhou with this G20 meeting, from the Chinese point of view, it's all about presenting Xi Jinping not to the world, but to his fellow Chinese as one of the most important leaders in the world. They're not focused on the Obama optics. They're focused on Xi. This is the single largest meeting of world leaders that China has ever hosted. And the G20 is China's opportunity to set international rules or to be seen to the Chinese as setting rules.
Wait a minute. I want to understand this. Are you saying that the president of China and the Communist Party more broadly that governs China, they don't particularly care what they look like to the rest of the world? They only want to make sure that their domestic constituencies are satisfied?
The domestic constituencies are far more important. Both the ordinary Chinese people who are very active now on the internet, the Chinese Communist Party, and the PLA. This is G20 is a performance of power primarily for the Chinese, only secondarily for audiences in America and the rest
this
of the world.
This leads to a question for you and also a question for Scott Horsley. A bottom line question, as best you can determine as someone who studies China, how stable is China?
There have been a growing number of voices that point to fractures within the Chinese political and economic system, and which have been predicting that China might either economically have a hard landing or politically be facing a possible dissolution of the authority of the Chinese Communist Party. Certainly, American strategists have to assume that the Communist Party remains in power for the foreseeable future.
That's where I want to bring Scott Horsley back into this conversation. Scott, having covered the White House for years and knowing that President Obama has wanted to turn American attention toward East Asia and toward China for quite some years, what are the assumptions that the administration makes about Chinese leadership, about their interests, about their durability?
Well, they have certainly found that President Xi is much more of a nationalist than his predecessor, and that has affected their calculation. But you're right, a centerpiece of this president, President Obama's foreign policy, has been to ramp up the United States' profile in the Asia-Pacific. He felt like under George W. Bush, that was a region that was neglected while so much attention was focused on Iraq and Afghanistan and the Middle East. Asia is home to the fastest growing economies. It's obviously the home to an enormous chunk of the world's population. So economically and strategically, President Obama feels like it is a region where the United States needs to raise its profile, and he has done that diplomatically by attending meetings like the Southeast Asian Summit that he'll be going to next. That's his next stop on this Asia tour. It's also the reason for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big Asia-Pacific trade deal. That's an economic way for the United States to raise its profile in this fast-growing region. Obviously, it's a deal that has become sort of a political pinata here at home, and the president's facing really long odds in getting that big trade deal ratified in the United States. If he's unable to do that, that would be a big black eye in the Asia-Pacific region, and a lot of folks there will be wondering, what is the U.S. staying power in this region?
And I guess we have Robert Daly. I called you John Daly. Congratulations.
That's my brother.
Golfing, that's great. Your brother John. Robert Daly, how much has it affected this relationship that China has been at the center or near the center of the presidential campaign, and that this trade deal with other Asian nations has been near the center of the presidential campaign?
China is very accustomed to being a political football during the presidential campaigns. They've become fairly sophisticated observers, so they are not terribly put out when Donald Trump in particular attacks China during the campaign. They've seen this with its predecessors. The TPP is something that China watches much more closely. President Obama has his favorite line on the TPP is that China wants to make the rules for the 21st century. That is unacceptable. We have to make the rules. It's a political pitch for an economic and trade relationship. China, when it hears that line, hears that China is incapable of making worthwhile rules and that the United States rebalance to Asia, which Scott just described, is in fact aimed at containing and surrounding China.
And I just want to mention we are a few minutes away from a news conference with President Obama. We'll take that live from China today.
And it looks like that news conference is ahead of us like in 15 or 20 minutes, which is
okay.
Gives us a little more time to
talk a little bit later
and work this out, because I actually have some questions about the TPP and Trump and China's relationship to Trump. But as we said earlier, China is hosting President Obama among the other leaders of the world's 20 leading economies this weekend. China's government sent something like 2 million residents out of the city, Hangzhou, where this summit is taking place. This is to remind people Obama's final trip to Asia as president. And we're going to hear now from NPR's Anthony Kuhn, who I spoke to earlier in Hangzhou. So China's hosting the G20 for the first time. And what is the importance of that?
Well, at this summit, Renee, President Xi Jinping made it clear that from now on, the G20 and not the G7 group of industrial nations is going to be the main body for global economic governance. And China intends to play a central and active role in that. China's been pushing to get a seat at the table of rulemakers that is fitting with its status as the world's second largest economy. It's going to continue to do that, and it's going to emphasize even more the interests of developing nations in general. There was a metaphor made last night. They took the heads of state on a boat cruise on Hangzhou's scenic West Lake, and the metaphor is that all countries are in the same boat, and China and President Xi Jinping are at its helm.
And within that, did China offer prescriptions for the world economy?
Well, President Xi Jinping's basic message is that nations need to harness technical innovation and use all available policy tools to pump up economic growth. They need to fight a rising tide of economic protectionism. Now, Xi Jinping himself was very cautious about touting any sort of development model that China might have to offer the world. But he didn't hesitate to point out that he used to be the governor of this province that we're in now, and that it made tremendous progress and advanced very quickly and became wealthy very quickly.
And President Xi and Obama did talk for hours, I gather, on Saturday night. How did that go?
Well, both sides came out with a long list of issues on which they agreed. Most of these were economic and climate change things. They also issued a list of things on which they did not agree, in particular, the South China Sea and human rights. China has been building on islands in the South China Sea, and it's become one of the main issues of contention between China and its neighbors in the U.S. And there's just no indication that we can see that the leaders here achieved any sort of meeting of minds.
And this is, of course, President Obama's last summit. I mean, he's effectively a lame duck. How much is China actually looking to work with him, or is it looking over his shoulder to his successor?
Well, you know, this summit really takes precedence over everything for the moment for China. And they're not going to do anything to make waves until it's over. Now, once it is over, people are going to be watching to see if they do things like, for example, continue to build on islands in the South China Sea or continue the trial of human rights lawyers. For the U.S., of course, the timing puts into question to what extent President Obama's policy of pivoting or rebalancing America's forces in focus to Asia will continue. But I think both sides have made it very clear that they really do not want any open military confrontation, and they're both going to work to avoid it.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn speaking to us from the G20 summit in Hangzhou, China. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Renee.
And he was speaking to us about an hour and so ago because he was stuck, actually, within the press area and couldn't get out until then, and is back again, I presume, in the press area. Let's touch on what we had been speaking of a little bit earlier, and that is the TPP and this whole question of the United States' relationship to Asia and South Asia, something that China is not, I gather, that thrilled about, that the U.S. is trying to impose its own power in that area. But as we all know, Donald Trump has been basically very negative about the TPP or any of these trade agreements. So how is that playing in China?
Well, not only Donald Trump, but of course Hillary Clinton has also come out strongly against the TPP, having previously been seen in China and the United States as one of its primary architects. Scott mentioned that this is really the economic pillar of the American rebalance to Asia, which then Secretary Clinton played a key role in forming and in announcing. The Chinese have had a mixed view on TPP. Initially, it was seen as purely being aimed at China because it excluded China. It was seen as part of America's effort to
gathering
allies against China. However, over the past 2 years or so, we've seen more economists within China that say, actually, if China were to join TPP in the second tranche, China could use TPP accession, as it did WTO accession in 2001, as a lever to move economic reforms, domestic economic reforms, forward that China wants to carry out anyway. In the long run, China might want to join the TPP if it comes into force.
I want to mention a couple of acronyms there. WTO, the World Trade Organization.
The World Trade Organization.
Giant framework of rules, trade rules around the world, and China signed on to
that. Which China joined in 2001, and since then its GDP has increased 600%. Per capita GDP is up 850%. So China has been a beneficiary of some of these rules.
Haven't you had some personal experience with the Chinese people over the last number of weeks and their views of the presidential campaign?
I have. In July, during the conventions, actually, I was conducting a national lecture tour in Chinese at the invitation of the American Embassy in Beijing to talk about the elections and the American democratic process.
Nothing much to talk about there.
Nothing much to talk about. The Chinese are paying close attention, but are not terribly impressed. The Chinese press has used the fact that we have two unpopular candidates as an opportunity to say, American democracy is failing in keeping with America's decline. America likes to preach to us about how efficacious democracy is, but look at us. We've got a Xi Jinping who came up through a meritocracy, tried and true, and America has two candidates that people don't much care for. So the Chinese are watching the elections very closely, but also with a degree of skepticism.
I just want to mention for people, full disclosure here, we told you we were waiting a news conference by President Obama in China. We're waiting even longer than we thought. He's going to talk in the next hour. But this has actually been really worthwhile to have a discussion of the United States and China. And so I want to take a couple of more minutes and wrap this up. So you go on this lecture tour, Robert Daly. You're talking with people about the election and you're talking with them in Chinese. You must get some responses back, questions from the audience, people chatting with you afterward.
Get a lot of that. We actually did some voting as well, and the Chinese seem to break, and this is purely anecdotal, about 60-40 for Trump,
for
which
Trump.
Is consistent with some of the other polling there.
Voting like they, everybody hold up your hands.
I would have people vote.
For those who have not heard how popular Donald Trump is in China, what is the appeal?
I think that there are several kinds of appeal that Trump has there. One is that he's a strongman, and China likes strongmen. Vladimir Putin is also very popular. Xi Jinping is seen as a strongman and a nationalist. Speaking in follow-up conversations with the Chinese, I found, too, that some support for Trump comes simply from the bread and circus side. He's very entertaining. They like to know what he's going to say next. And then the majority of Trump supporters, it turned out, upon closer questioning, actually think that he'll be bad for the United States in ways that could be good for China. That's a big part of his support.
This is something that's caught attention here in the United States. You did hear that opinion expressed that people said, I favor Trump because I'm Chinese and it's bad for America.
That is an interpretation of what they said after further questioning. They think that he will accelerate American decline and isolation. They think that protectionist policies are bad for America and that, yes, that is an opportunity for China.
Scott Horsley, I'd like to know if you have any sense from the White House officials you cover every day, how disappointed, if at all, President Obama is that not only the Republican Party in the form of Donald Trump, but the Democratic Party in the form of Hillary Clinton have turned against his signature trade deal and have in different ways been critical of his approach, in effect, to China and his approach to East Asia more broadly.
I don't think there is a great surprise that Hillary Clinton would, for political purposes, not champion the TPP during this campaign season. After all, Barack Obama spoke very negatively about trade deals like the North American Free Trade Agreement when he was running for president. The president's a sophisticated politician. He understands that, especially in a Democratic primary, that's the kind of thing you do. And Hillary Clinton announced her opposition to the TPP during a heated primary battle with Bernie Sanders. And so it was, I think, generally seen that Bernie Sanders was pulling her in that direction, and it was sort of a political feint.
Except a little hard to go back on that now.
But she was careful about it, though, the way she said she was against. She was against certain parts of it, the parts
she said,
that didn't work.
From what I've seen now, I can't support it in its current form and so forth, which might have left a little bit of wiggle room. More recently, though, you know, her position has really hardened, and I think it would be very difficult for her now to reverse course were she to become president. And I think that has been maybe a surprise to people at the White House. I think, you know, a certain amount of political expedience they could have understood, but now that she has really kind of locked herself in a way that Barack Obama did not necessarily do when he was running back in 2007 and 2008. For example, you know, Barack Obama later turned around and adopted the Korean Free Trade Agreement that had been negotiated by his predecessor with some changes. They made some tweaks to it, but he left himself the wiggle room to do that in a way that I think Hillary Clinton maybe has not done. So really now the White House sees their only opportunity to ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership as that window of time during the lame duck session after the election and before this Congress goes home. And it's a narrow window. It's going to be a long shot for them to get that done.
And just a reminder, the Trans-Pacific Partnership does not actually include China, as we were mentioning earlier, but it is seen as being all about China. Just about 20 seconds here, Robert Daly. Is it your sense that despite all the fireworks that the U.S. and Chinese governments see some shared interests?
Oh, they see a number of shared interests, and we saw that in particular with their decision to ratify the Paris Climate Change Agreement. They are working together to combat pandemics. They do have joint interests in trade, which has been beneficial to both countries. Yes, there are shared interests, but there's also a true security dilemma in the South China Sea.
Okay, that's Robert Daly. He is the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the U.S., the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington. We're also joined by NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. And we are awaiting a news conference from Hangzhou, China, which is where President Obama has attended a summit of the world's leading economy leaders. We'll bring you that news conference later on NPR News.